worked with a person who, in one context, a code black was a bomb threat. And at a different place they worked, a code black was everyone's dead because it was a big event. They said, listen, we need some people here. We're going to code black. And when you're like sitting listening going, I hope that doesn't mean what they think it means. I hope it doesn't mean what I think it means.
Hey there. If you've joined the podcast today, my name is Chris Jarvis. I work with companies on employee giving and volunteering programs.
And my name is Jake McIsaac. I spend a lot of time thinking about public safety and restorative justice.
So we are having conversations here that we've been having for 20 years.
Yeah. The only difference now is we press record and share it with you.
Thanks for joining us.
On today's episode, Chris reflects on a recent trip to Alabama, what he was thinking, and more importantly, what he was feeling at the time. That kicks off a whole discussion about whether or not there is a they out there controlling the world, or more uncomfortably, we have to admit that it's just us, and what it looks like to take responsibility for those systems. Finally, Chris has this weird moment of boomer-splaining a whole bunch of new terms that he's learning on TikTok. It's a wild ride today. Hope you stick around. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Jake, you know, I don't know if you watch TikTok much. I'm a bit of a junkie for it myself.
Your demographic. It's what everyone's saying.
It's for me.
way to kill the TikTok market right there.
Well, look, I'm not putting up content. I'm just a consumer. Okay. So I'm not ruining it. Perfect. But I came across this guy. He's a middle school teacher, Mr. Lindsay. And his account's blowing up because he's sharing these really crazy insights from being a middle school teacher. And it's kind of like I'm hearing from somebody teaching students on a different planet and they're a different species. Anyway, let me play this for you, okay?
I've gotten so many requests to talk about this one. This one is called mewing, okay? Not meowing, mewing. Now, mewing's been around for a while. It's this exercise where you put your tongue to the roof of your mouth and you swallow, and it's supposed to like strengthen and accentuate your jawline and get rid of a double chin if you have one. So the action of mewing has started to trend and has been trending on TikTok. People are teaching you like how to mew, get rid of your double chin, all that good stuff. But there's another trending aspect of it, which is what the kids are now using in the classroom or at home. Now, when you're mewing, you can't talk because you have the tongue to the roof of your mouth and you're swallowing. So the trending part of it is when somebody comes up and asks you a question, particularly if it's a teacher or a parent, and you don't want to answer the question, you hit them with the, which simply means, I can't answer your question right now, I'm mewing. I'm working on my jawline, I'm doing my jawline exercises. Now kids, particularly teenage boys, are finding a lot of joy in using it in the classroom at home when they don't want to answer a question. A teacher will be like, oh, what's the answer to this question? Johnny, what do you think about this? And Johnny will hit her with the, which just means, I can't answer your question right now, I'm you. Hopefully now that you know what that means and why they're doing it, it'll help you be able to combat it a little bit at home or in the classroom. Basically hit them with the, you can mew on your own time, answer my question.
All right, so the quiet part of that is where he makes it, close your mouth and make the gesture along the jawline. And if anybody wants to see it, we'll have it in the show notes. But have you heard of mewing before?
Yes.
You had?
Mm-hmm.
I had not. I knew nothing about this.
Doesn't hurt to have 14 and 16-year-old stuff. Yeah. I couldn't have it done to me, but I tested that with them. When you put your finger, there's a shushing motion, right? Shushing motion.
And then the line.
Your head to the side and.
Just draw it down the side of your jaw. Yeah. Like, I would love to talk, but I'm really busy fixing this issue.
No, I don't think it's I would love to talk. It's like, don't talk to me. Don't talk to me. I'm doing something for myself.
Maybe. Here's another one for Gen Z or Alpha or whoever this demographic is. Explain Riz and use it in a sentence.
Riz? Isn't it like your charm or your ability to have swagger or something?
Yeah, it's a swagger, charm, off the hook, lit, all mashed up into a bunch of different variations depending on how you decide to use it. And I mean, this is like a generation, 4 years between these kids, and there's a very tight vocab developing in this age group. It is amazing. What's
Okay, well, but didn't we, I mean, we would have had similar, like, I'm trying to imagine going up to kids these days, holding up my hand when they go to, you know, do a high five or dap me up, going, psych. Probably these things that drove our parents absolutely bananas too at a certain age. It's like, that was, yeah.
Psych is interesting because we kind of all know what it means now, or psyched out. But when it was first being used, like, psych is in, do you mean it's in psychology? Is it just psych, not psychology? Like, yeah, I guess you're right. It's all weird.
What is interesting about that, though, if you don't know the code,
yeah,
hard to figure out that that's about strengthening your jawline. So no idea. Going way underground. Like, they might know that it's a strengthened jawline or whatever it was that he was saying, but all I could interpret from that is, don't talk to me, talk to someone else. Move along, boomer. It doesn't matter. Everyone is not them, boomer.
Boomer. Another one is GYAT. GYAT. Yeah, we're not going to explain that one, but the kids will say it, and the teacher will say, yeah. What did you say? Oh, get your act together. Yeah. Or any number of GYAT. It does not mean that. But again, it'll be in the show notes. You can look it up. No cap. No cap, Jake. Okay.
This may be the worst ever. I don't know what to do with any of this right now.
That's a really interesting thing about language, is it's not fixed. They're just sounds that we make, and we all sort of have a consensus about what will mean generally, and then we just pass that along to the next group that shows up. Nobody spoke Latin, but we all just showed up in a Latin country, and now, well, I guess we're going to talk this way as opposed to Mandarin or whatever. You could use any language, but and they evolve, and meaning is very much whatever we kind of decide it's going to be. And I think that's an interesting aspect of our existence, just that we give meaning to things.
Well, that is kind of interesting. I overheard a conversation recently at work between a couple coworkers who were, and I don't think they were being mean, but they were just kind of reflecting on how another newer coworker called something in over the radio. So they were a license plate or something like that.
Okay.
And we use sort of alphanumeric common.
Foxtrot, Zebra,
all of them, right?
Okay. Delta Niner.
So they were saying, one person was saying to the other one, did you know that we don't say Bravo here anymore? We say banana. And I was like, what? Yeah, that's what we're going to start saying now. We're not going to use Bravo anymore. We're going to say, you know, if it were Bravo, Mike, Juliet, we're going to say Banana, Mary, Jupiter. Okay. Where is it from? Why would you say that? What's going on here? And they're like, oh, that's what the new guy said. Ha, 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 ha. I was like, did you understand what they were trying to convey? Yeah, guess it worked. Like, at some point, what difference does it make? Sure, Bravo and banana, but you got the B, right? Like, you kind of figured out what they were trying to call in. You could still do the thing. And it is helpful, though. It gets a little bit, we often will say in our world, plain language.
Yeah.
Because in crisis situations, if you start using code, and I don't remember or I forget what the code is or interpret it wrong, it can have dire consequences. I worked with a person who, in one context, a code black was a bomb threat. And at a different place they worked, a code black was everyone's dead because it was a big event. Well, I don't know if they called a code black.
Did you have code blacks being called in either of those situations? I think that's more important.
No.
Okay, thank God.
No.
Gee whiz.
But they said, listen, we need some people here. We got a code black. And when you're like sitting listening going, I hope that doesn't mean what they think it means. I hope it doesn't mean what I think it means. What's happening? What is happening there? Like, just plain language. Enough code. Come on.
When code is actually more confusing than the language itself.
It's high risk stuff. Anyway, but it does evolve, right? These things evolve and it shifts meaning, which I think is what you're kind of mewing conversations about.
Mewing. Well, so we bring meaning to these different words, or we invent new words, and then a nuance of the word. And it doesn't, and by we, it could be just a group of 13 to 17 year olds, just who, for some reason that we don't understand, these new words catch on and spread and are universally understood across large geographical areas. It's just amazing that as a species we do that. But we also, and I think this is interesting too, and I've been thinking about this a bit, the meaning that we bring to our own experiences kind of determines the truth of those experiences, and what we can and cannot do with them. For example, very much like mewing, I didn't know what that meant. So if I heard it, it meant nothing to me. I could try and figure it out, but I had no access. We tell ourselves stories about ourselves. I'm a lazy, you know, I find that I procrastinate and I feel bad about that. And I tell myself, oh, you are a procrastinator. That's by definition, a character of your, who is Chris? Oh, a procrastinator. I would, a better thing to do would be to say, I find that sometimes I choose to procrastinate and I'm trying to figure out why. You know, that's it. It's sort of like, that's something I'm dealing with. Like, I'm kind of into Guinness blonde beer these days. And I'm curious as to why. Like, it's, but it's not, I'm not Guinness blonde beer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, when you go to a monument or you go somewhere, they have, if it's not very clear what it's about, there's like an interpretive plaque. So you stand there where you're standing here, you look over here, there's a little write-up about what happened on this property or these lands.
Yeah.
And it starts to poke and prod you toward sense making. Like, what are the things that they want you to understand? So instead of, we saw this, I don't know, in the US a few years ago when statues were being toppled everywhere.
Yeah.
The counterbalance that was, well, if you tear it all down, there's no reference point historically to look back and say, where do you harness the outrage? So maybe we don't topple. Maybe we give more information. So if once upon a time this was celebrated, maybe we tell a different story here. We saw this in Halifax with Cornwallis statues, for instance. Or like, what do you do?
Yeah, so for the listeners, Cornwallis was the... I think, I don't even know if he was, he's just the rank of captain or something like that. He came over with a handful of ships to Chibucto Harbor, which is now Halifax, and established a colony in 1750.
Right? They stole land. You could also, like, it all depends on how you tell the story.
That's an interesting angle, Jake. So the meaning, my default meaning is a storyline that I was learned when I was a little kid, and it left out a lot of things like information about the Mi'kmaq, how to say their name, actually, where they came from, what actually was going on. And then Lord Cornwallis showed up and yada, yada, yada. So that is embedded so deeply inside of me that whenever we even have a conversation, that's the meaning that automatically comes to it. And unless I'm intentional in this moment, unless I can kind of catch that instantaneous meaning making, I would just go along with it, unless I was talking to somebody like you, obviously, who's thoughtful, attentive, and lives a considered life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tried to catch him there. Catch him in real time.
Aha, Perry.
Not today, Satan, not today. Okay, so here's another question.
Oh my gosh.
The folks who taught you that, were they bad people?
No. They were working with what they had too. So this leaving out of information and points of view creates a very interesting truth later.
Yeah. I mean, I think about the curriculum, right? That was the educator, like my teachers taught. As you were telling that story, I could almost close my eyes and imagine the books that we were reading as kids that had the little pictures and they were the paintings drawn in and who was on the land and who was in the water looking like they were coming here with power and truth and civilization, and they called it, this was civilized, these were savage,
like medicine,
all of these, and it set up a storyline that made sense.
Yep.
That, right, to a kid, it makes sense, and you kind of hear it and you learn it and you go along with it, and you never actually have to do the work of figuring out what does that really mean until we get this age.
Yeah, and it's hard to question it on your own. It's a bit like, that joke, and I'm sure I've said it on the podcast one season or another, but it's like fish swimming through water. An older fish passes the two young fish and says, "Hey guys, how's the water today?" And the young fish swim by and they look at each other and whisper, "What is water?" You just don't, you have no idea. I wouldn't know when I was younger that there was another point of view to be had, to even go looking for. And that's why I think it's important. So interestingly, this connects with just something that I experienced last week, which was going to Montgomery, Alabama, and visiting the Equal Justice Initiative Legacy Museum. And the truth of the horrific actions in the United States is only partially known. There's so much more. It is overwhelming how much information is in that building. It was overwhelming and exhausting. I couldn't, there's just too much to take in. You just had to skip sections after a while. It's like, there can't be this much horror related to slavery and then transitioning to basically incarceration in the jail system. It's just, it is overwhelming. But I live gleefully without any of that info and without any of it and without that building. I am not confronted with the gaps in my own knowledge. I just don't know them.
It's interesting because you're talking systems, right? Slavery, the mass incarceration of Black bodies, particularly Black and brown bodies, particularly in the U.S.
Yeah.
And in the middle is this other system that fuels that pipeline through schools and through how we educate, who gets to learn certain things,
right,
access to education. Like
it's
like preset, preformed. And when you step back and you look at it in the context of slavery, you can see that, or at least there in Montgomery, you were able to see it up close.
Laid bare. I mean, just in the most, not the most horrific way, but the most tolerably horrific way, I would think. Some of the sculptures and just, it is upsetting.
But then lots of us are like those fish that you described, the what's water.
Like, I had no idea. I didn't even know the museum was there. I get invited by my partner, Angela Parker, and we went down. This other organization it's an educational organization, EverFi, really great to invite us. They do an event each year, bring a small group of people down, and it's basically meant to be an immersive experience. We have a little brief, we go and we have this experience, and we process it throughout the day, but then we come back and we kind of talk about what it meant. So that lined up with, obviously, the kind of work we do. And even Brian Stevenson, the gentleman who has tirelessly worked, he's been the champion for this. I only know so little about him. Angela, and she knows much more.
So when you went and you had the brief, what were you thinking going into that? How do you prepare to, you're going there, you know what you're going to.
Yeah. I didn't know what I was going to. I could imagine what I thought it was, and it was more intense. But because of the kind of work that we do, obviously, and I had mentioned this to you before, but just for what we're talking about now, on the way there, I was in one of the lounges, and they have the bathrooms in there, unlike most American or Canadian bathrooms. They go, floor to ceiling. There's a door. It's like a room. It's like a little tiny room. There's no passing toilet paper, extra toilet paper under the door like in Seinfeld. It's not possible. If you're out, you're on your own. Yeah, exactly. You are on your own in there. Nobody's going to spare a square. And that, I got thinking, that was Elaine's line, can you spare a square? This is about the size of a solitary confinement room that a Black gentleman has been in for, I don't know if it's 15 or 20 years in Texas. And the state has continually found a way to defy his constitutional rights. And he's just in there. And it's not a serious, I don't believe it is. Like, he's a mass murderer. And it's nothing like that. He's just, and as I'm sitting there or in that room, I think, this is your room, Chris. This is it for 20 years, for the next 20 minutes, for the next 20 days, 20 months, 20 years, forever. As far as you're concerned, you're going to be in this room. There's no difference. This is just a light. There's a toilet. I will not see anybody else. And I began to, I kind of got myself worked up into a bit of a panic because I do this kind of thing where we ask people to imagine what it would be like to be in another person's shoes as part of empathy building. I got really detailed and I started to think, what am I going to think about? What stories do I have? There are no more stories. Save your stories. Think of your stories. What have you watched on TV? Recount it. Is there a place to write it down? Like, what are you going to do? How are you going to get to sleep? You have so many things. Should you stay fit? What would working out be? Like, I began to really try to plan a day and visualize myself day after day. And it became very claustrophobic and freakishly awful. But that, I think, would be, in answer to your question, yeah, I did that little experiment to try and do some pre-work so that when I showed up, there was a bit of conditioning, but it wasn't enough.
It is interesting to hear you tell the story from that position, because there's probably a whole bunch of people outside of that little cell who would comfortably tell the story that people, bad people, dangerous people, are squirreled away like that to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it doesn't matter what their experience is, whether they suffer or don't suffer, just so long as they're away from us. Mm-hmm. Lots of people, I think, hope that prison is also a place where people are suffering. I think because it's not enough to be separated from society. There is certainly a lot of folks who want bad things to happen there too, to those who are imprisoned. But overwhelmingly, just never having to think about it and believing that the system exists to keep me safe. That exactly what you described keeps me as not a lawbreaker, safer.
Yeah, and obviously that's the intoxicating myth that keeps us safe. But the problem is when the line changes, then the us line changes. All of a sudden, yeah, you're not on the us, you're on the they line. And you know, Jake, we're so quick to do this. In the debrief, you were asking about the brief and the debrief from prep. When people were reflecting, we do one where we try to create some cognitive dissonance at the beginning. Like, we'll tell people that came to feed the poor that the poor don't need them to come and ladle out food. The real reason you're here is to receive a gift. And we explain that from the poor. They will remind them about what really matters. And we don't need to go into that here, but that is very disorienting because most people who came to make a difference are all of a sudden, I don't need anything from homeless Susie. Like, that seems weird and immoral and incorrect and wrong, because it just, you say it all the time. I love it. Unfamiliar feels unsafe, but unfamiliar is not unsafe. And it is very unfamiliar to lose your power to the powerless. There's probably nothing more disorienting than to have all of your power taken away. So we do this in the brief, and we ask people to, we invite people into this disorienting dilemma, where we try to create some proximity with the people we're going to work with, or at least imagine in our minds that we are somehow doing something with, not for, not to, but with. Okay. At the back end, we ask two questions. What did you experience? Was it what you expected? And this is meant to invite us to not do an evaluation of the event or how well it was run, or even do a sort of an arm's length overview of the issues that you confronted, meaning, could you pass a test on the topic? what we're asking is, don't tell us what child labor was like or how well the hospital did. Tell us what you experienced in the labor, right? That's a different kind of question. And it draws you to think quite differently about the experience. So at the end, as we're going around and people are moving towards sort of a, here's what I now know about the information. Here's what I didn't know. Here's what I've learned. Here's how I feel about what I've learned. When I get to me, I was stuck on the fact that I noticed a pattern in the reflection where we talked about, we want a good thing and they want a bad thing. And we need to be doing these things because they are going to be doing those things. So it was very, very clear, us and them. But the thing that I realized, Jake, in that museum was that I was the we. Like we did this. Every single person sitting in that circle, no matter how you feel about it, you're part of the we. If the we, because the we emanates the system. And you may not agree with it, but we pay taxes, we live in accordance to it, we buy in accordance to it. It is humanly impossible to not be a part of it. It just, that's not possible. So that's not what I'm asking us to do or anything, but I think it's, for me, it was a big step to be able to just be able to say, I saw George Floyd's murder up there. And I have to say, we were wrong to do that. And that puts you in the story in a way that's just really uncomfortable.
What you're describing is a really important tenet of a restorative approach. When asked to have people think restoratively about something, there's this principle of individual and collective responsibility. So those two are in tension. So okay. It is always asking that we question in every context.
Okay.
So you don't get to be an independent convener or the facilitator between parties. Lots of restorative justice practitioners do that in terms of practices, would say, I'm going to bring this person and this person together, the victim, the offender, maybe the community member. Mm-hmm. But a restorative approach is doing exactly what you're saying is, what are the systems here? What are the we? What are the lessons that we need to learn? So even as I glimpse the conflict between these two parties, if I look a little bit deeper, there's a we answer here. There's transformative properties. So it starts to signal for us the rest of the work, the why this matters, that we need to get this right and have this reconciled. And otherwise, it's just a nice trip to Montgomery. If it makes no difference in the world, it got you thinking, but if it doesn't change the world fundamentally going forward, or at least your runway, then it's only backwards looking. And the other principle that we have in a restorative approach is this principle of forward focused. Each principle holds the other in tension. So if I'm looking at the what's the we thing for us in this, I also have to look for the what's the we thing in it for us going forward, not just going backwards. We look back to learn, we look back to pay attention, we look back to hear how this has been for people, but we take those learnings, set a plan for the future. So we think and act and do differently. We think differently now so that we act and do differently tomorrow or in the future or going forward. So I love hearing you tell those things because our work, even though we do it in different spaces, is so aligned in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even what you just said there about looking forward means that we think and act as though now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, and this goes back to the stories we tell ourselves. If I tell myself a story, I am racist. Okay, good. That's fine. Factual. I have racist tendencies in me. Based on evolutionary biology, it would be absolutely impossible to not have racist tendencies in me. But what story do I tell myself with that? Do I say, I have racist tendencies, but they're not really mine, and it's not my fault, and I do other good things, and I shouldn't be held accountable, it's not fair. Like, what is the story that we we wrap around that, not that emanates from, but we kind of wrap around and mesh across it? Or do we say, I am part of the we then and now and in the future? If my society acts in a racist way, I am participating in it by just being alive. Where do I go from there? What is my we from there? What is my we into the future? How can we shift? And thinking about how can we shift doesn't make it, that's a little different. I'm absolutely curious to see how in your space the people respond to this, because we tend to look forward, stupid pronouns, I'm stuck using them in a bunch of different ways now, but we look forward and we think, oh, this is who I am, this is where I want to be. We need to make sure they don't win the election. We need to make sure they don't, those Christian nationalists don't take over and make us all go to church 6 days a week. We need to, you know what I mean? There is looking forward by default, we kind of have a we against them mindset. But if what you said, based on what we were just talking about, is what if we was inclusive? What if there is really no they? It's just a figment of our evolutionary minds from 100,000 years ago. There is no they. There is only a we. Then how do you address the future? Because I'm not fighting somebody. You know, what are we going to do together? I'm not sure I know how to do that.
That's fascinating. So there's some reflective moments around the who we are together. So yeah. So when you're talking about your debrief, I was thinking about one of the slight, tricks or practices or ways that we do it, the techniques that we have when we're doing a debrief in a restorative way, is not so that we just go around and hear from everyone. Mm-hmm. Because the tendency is like, everyone answers the same question, but they're answering it through the person who posed the question. So if I'm the person at the front of the room and I said, I'd love to know what you thought about that. What were you thinking when you were at this event? And they're going to each talk to me. Their eyes are going to talk to me. Everyone's going to answer. And that's wildly unhelpful in a restorative process.
Why?
Everyone speak, but they're not talking to each other. They're talking to a facilitator, not a convener of a conversation with community.
So talking to the group is critical to the restorative
process. Critical.
I didn't know that till just now.
It is a failure if a facilitator is the point person. You can be the convener. So we do lots of weird things that look kind of rude. If you and I you'll love this because this is just who I am anyway. But if I had asked the question and I noticed that you were talking to me, I would look away and force you to look at someone else. You are not going to, if I look away, avert my gaze, pretend I'm making notes, do whatever, you're going to have to look to someone else in
this
circle.
That is, there's a behavioral science thing. Yes, absolutely. That is, you can force that behavior.
So we use that all the time.
Yes.
To make you look at other people. And then I'll glance at the person that you're looking to see if they're giving you back, like, okay, you're being heard. Mm-hmm. Not being heard by me, a facilitator, but being heard by this group. Because we are going to sense make in round two. In the first, I've asked you, what did you hear? What did you experience? Whatever. In the second round, I'm going to ask you to build now that you've heard from everyone, which you didn't have the benefit of when the first time you spoke. Except if the last person.
You've shared this before. I love this part. You go around. Now that you've heard, you
can make everyone else an adjustment. What would you like to be heard differently on? So it gives you an ability to move. Would you like to build on, or what stands out?
That's good.
And the test is when you hear people start to refer to other people in the circle.
That's good.
Well, it's like what Chris said. I really like what Chris said about when he was there. And that's when you know, as a facilitator, your job's done, because you can step back and they will already start making those connections to the work. You're starting to build shared understanding of your sense making. This is that rational.
That's good. And you've decentered yourself. And there's not another individual who's centered, but maybe the idea of what the group is, the group's identity becomes central. And that's what we're kind of all responding to, which would enable cohesion. Otherwise, you're a genius with 1,000 helpers. And if you disappear, they disappear. Yeah.
And you get more access to the diversity that we said was important.
Exactly. Yes. Because now the avenues are open.
And they're talking to each other about something that they probably would not have otherwise been able to do.
New behaviors.
Because you've created a bit of a relational moment. Yep. I can see you. I'm listening to you. Yep. I'm listening to you from a learner posture, but I also know that you're engaging with me the same way. My friend Jennifer has this, I don't know if it's her quote or not, but she says this thing about transformation moves at the pace of trust. And so if you can build,
it is though?
No.
Yeah, it's a 7 Habits.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, like Stephen Covey?
The book is called The Speed of Trust. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, there you go. The transformation moves at the speed of trust. So, which it always has stuck with me as it's pretty good. If we can get those micro flashes of relationship to people, if they're listening and willing to let you in, like if I'm willing to learn from you and hear you, I've kind of got to drop the walls just a bit. Otherwise, we're just going to argue. We'd be adversarial.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Because we've got identities crashing into each other, looking to validate their value, like prove that they belong in a social group. And that's not what the conversation needs to be about in the first place. So it's a dynamic, but you don't have to pay attention. Jake, you know what? We should have done the entire episode just about having good reflection in a circle, like engaging each other. That's great. We should do that sometime. Just the entire thing on here's how you make these way more productive.
Yeah. Well, we could have more than just two of us do that.
All right. Well, that's, I appreciate you kind of working through this with me a little bit. It's interesting to think about how we can access meaning and the posture we need to take, which in the end is much less about me trying to figure it out and enter it myself so much as it is just trying to decenter myself and taking a we posture in the whole thing and just putting myself in the story, but not making myself the center of the story. That's a subtle difference, but I know what I mean by that based on what we just talked about.
You are signaling a more thoughtful, intentional evolution of not just language like we started with, but of thought, of identity, of who we are in the world. Like it's not just passively we're getting older and light world's changing and maybe my values and views shift. Hopefully they do, but this is kind of how do you recalibrate with that intention? Like we actually know where we want to go.
Yeah.
Or we believe we know where we want to go. How do we get more of that? So you're kind of looking for those. It's like going to the gym, I suppose. And today is leg day. We're going to work this part of our body.
Well, you know, the evolve with intention is a really interesting idea because the first thing I have come to understand is there's a lot more agency over who I am than I was made aware of earlier. I sort of felt like I was given my identity now. I didn't then. I just was, this is me, this is me, this is me. And then I began to realize, no, well, this is a part of me, but that's not me from, you know, inner family systems therapy. Then there's the us and them and all the dynamics of all my cognitive bias, which others, a whole bunch of people. Okay, well, I got to overcome that. And then you can actually develop parts of your brain and different ways of seeing the world through this transformative learning experience. Like you begin to realize this life can be far more what you want it to be, even at the level of deciding, is what I want, what I want, and why.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for your time. I appreciate the call.
This feels like a weird way to end. Just like, all right, see you later. See you next time.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Fine, whatever. All right. Talk to you soon.